This hemisphere was lifted straight out, or up, from the body of the ship some 6 or 8 feet. I could not see what held it out from the hull, but I assumed that there must be a central shaft or piston. It came out like a poppet valve. It was easy to see why the masters of the saucer had not closed up again and taken off from there. The airlock was fouled, held open by a mud turtle, one of those little amphibious tanks which were at home on the bottom of a harbor or crawling up onto a beach, part of the landing force of the Fulton. Let me set down now what I learned later. The tank was commanded by Ensign Gilbert Calhoun of Knoxville. With him was Powerman Second Class Florence Berzowski and a gunner named Booker T.W. Johnson. They were all dead, of course, before we got there. The car, as soon as I rode it, was surrounded by a landing force squad, commanded by a pink-cheeked lad who seemed anxious to shoot somebody or anybody. He was less anxious when he got a look at Mary, but he still refused to let us approach the saucer until we had checked with his tactical commander, who in turn consulted the skipper of the Fulton. We got an answer back in a short time, considering that the demand must have been referred to Rexton, and probably clear back to Washington. While waiting, I watched the battle and, from what I saw, was well pleased to have no part of it. Somebody was going to get hurt. A good many had already. There was a male body, stark naked, just behind the car. A boy, not more than 14. He was still clutching a rocket launcher, and across his shoulders was the mark of the beast, though the slug was nowhere around. I wondered whether the slug had crawled away and was dying, or whether perhaps it had managed to transfer to the person who had bayoneted the boy. Mary had walked west on the highway with the downy young naval officer while I was examining the corpse. The notion of a slug, possibly still alive, being around caused me to hurry to her. "Get back into the car," I said. She continued to look west along the road. "I thought I might get in a shot or two," she answered, her eyes bright. "She's safe here," the youngster assured me. "We're holding them, well down the road." I ignored him. "Listen, you bloodthirsty little hellion," I snapped. "Get back in that car before I break every bone in your body." "Yes, Sam." She turned and did so. I looked back at the young salt. "What are you staring at?" I demanded, feeling edgy and needing someone to take it out on. The place smelled of slugs, and the weight was making me nervous. "Nothing much," he said, looking me over. "In my part of the country, we don't speak to ladies that way." "Then why in the hell don't you go back where you came from?" I answered, and stalked away. The old man was missing, too. I did not like it. An ambulance, coming back from the west, ground to a halt beside me. "Has the road to Pascagoula been opened?" the driver called out. The Pascagoula River, 30 miles or so east of where the saucer had landed, was roughly zone amber for that area. The town of that name was east of the river's mouth, and nominally, at least, in zone green, while 60 or 70 miles west of us, on the same road, was New Orleans, the heaviest concentration of Titans south of St. Louis. Our opposition came from New Orleans, while our nearest base was in Mobile. "I haven't heard," I told the driver. He chewed a knuckle. "Well, I made it through once. Maybe I'll get back all right." His turbines whined, and he was away. I continued to look for the old man. Although the ground fighting had moved away from the site, the air fighting was all around and above us. I was watching the vapor trails and trying to figure out who was what, and how they could tell, when a big transport streaked into the area, put on the brakes with a burst of radio units, and spilled a platoon of skyboys. Again, I wondered. It was too far away to tell whether they wore slugs or not. At least it came in from the east, but that did not necessarily prove anything. I spotted the old man, talking with the commander of the landing force. I went up and interrupted. "We ought to get out of here, boss. This place is due to be atom-bombed about 10 minutes ago." The commander answered me. "Relax," he said blandly. "The concentration does not permit A-bombing. Not even a pony bomb." I was just about to ask him sharply how he knew that the slugs would figure it that way, when the old man interrupted. "He's right, son." He took me by the arm and walked me back toward the car. "He's perfectly right, but for the wrong reasons." "Huh? Why haven't we bombed the cities they hold?" "They won't bomb this area. Not while the ship is intact. They don't want to damage it. They want it back. Now go on back to Mary. Dogs and strange men. Remember?" I shut up, unconvinced. I expected us all to be clicks on a Geiger counter any second. Slugs, fighting as individuals, fought with gamecock recklessness, perhaps because they were really not individuals. Why should they be any more cautious about one of their own ships? They might be more anxious to keep it out of our hands than save it. We had just reached the car and spoken to Mary, when the still damp little Snotty came trotting up. He halted, caught his breath, and saluted the old man. "The commander says that you are to have anything you want, sir. Anything at all." From his manner, I gathered that the answering dispatch had probably been spelled out in asterisks, accompanied by ruffles and flourishes. "Thank you, sir," the old man said mildly. "We merely want to inspect the captured ship." "Yes, sir, come with me, sir." He came with us instead, having difficulty making up his mind whether to escort the old man or Mary. Mary won. I came along behind, keeping my mind on watching out and ignoring the presence of the youngster. The country on that coast, unless gardened constantly, is practically jungle. The saucer lapped over into a break of that sort, and the old man took a shortcut through it. The kid said to him, "Watch out, sir. Mind where you step." I said, "Slugs?" He shook his head. "Coral snakes." At that point, a poisonous snake would have seemed as pleasant as a honeybee. But I must have been paying some attention to his warning, for I was looking down when the next thing happened. I first heard a shout, then, so help me, a Bengal tiger was charging us. Probably Mary got in the first shot. I know that mine was not behind that of the young officer. It might even have been ahead. I'm sure it was. Fairly sure, anyhow. It was the old man who shot last. Among the four of us, we cut the beast so many ways that it would never be worth anything as a rug. And yet the slug on it was untouched. I fried it with my second bolt. The young fellow looked at it without surprise. "Well," he said, "I thought we had cleaned up that load." "Huh, what do you mean?" "One of the first transport tanks they sent out. Regular Noah's Ark. We were shooting everything from gorillas to polar bears. Say, did you ever have a water buffalo come at you?" "No, and I don't want to." "Not nearly as bad as the dogs, really. If you ask me, those things don't have much sense." He looked at the slug, quite unmoved, while I was ready, as usual, to throw up. We got out of there fast, and onto the Titan ship, which did not make me less nervous, but more. Not that there was anything frightening in the ship itself, not in its appearance. But its appearance wasn't right. Well, it was obviously artificial. No one knew without being told that it was not made by men. Why? I don't know. The surface of it was a dull mirror. Not a mark on it. Not any sort of mark. There was no way to tell how it had been put together. It was as smooth as a Joe block. I could not tell of what it was made. Metal? Of course, it had to be metal. But was it? You could expect it to be either bitterly cold or possibly intensely hot from its landing. I touched it, and it was not anything at all, neither cold nor hot. Don't tell me it just happened to be exactly 98 6/10. I noticed another thing presently. A ship that size, landing at high speed, should have blasted a couple of acres. There was no blast area at all. The break around it was green and rank. We went up to the parasol business, the airlock, if that is what it was. The edge was jammed down tight on the little mud turtle. The armor of the tank was crushed in, as one might crush a pasteboard box with the hand. Those mud turtles are built to launch 500 feet in water. They are strong. Well, I suppose this one was strong. The parasol arrangement had damaged it, but the airlock had not closed. On the other hand, the metal, or whatever the spaceship's door was made of, was unmarked by the exchange. The old man turned to me. "Wait here with Mary. You're not going in there by yourself." "Yes, there may be very little time." The kid spoke up. "I'm to stay with you, sir. That's what the commander said." "Very well, sir," the old man agreed. "Come along." He peered over the edge, then knelt and lowered himself by his hands. The kid followed him. I felt burned up, but had no desire to argue the arrangements. They disappeared into the hole. Mary turned to me and said, "Sam, I don't like this. I'm afraid." She startled me. I was afraid myself, but I had not expected her to be. "I'll take care of you." "Do we have to stay?" He did not say so. "Quite." I considered it. "If you want to go back to the car, I'll take you back." "Well, no, Sam, I guess we have to stay. Come closer to me." She was trembling. I don't know how long it was before they stuck their heads over the rim. The youngster climbed out and the old man told him to stand guard. "Come on," he said to us. "It's safe, I think." "The hell it is," I told him. But I went because Mary was already starting. The old man helped her down. "Mind your head," he said. "Low bridge all the way." It is a platitude that unhuman races produce unhuman works. But very few humans have ever been inside a Venerian labyrinth, and still fewer have seen the Martian ruins. And I was not one of the few. I did not know what to expect. Superficially, the inside of the saucer was not, I suppose, too startling. But it was strange. It had been thought out by inhuman brains, ones which did not depend on human ideas and fabricating, brains which had never heard of the right angle and the straight line, or which regarded them as unnecessary or undesirable. We found ourselves in a very small oblate chamber, and from there we crawled through a tube about 4 feet thick. A tube which seemed to wind down into the ship, and which glowed from all its surface with a reddish light. The tube held an odd and somewhat distressing odor, as if of marsh gas, and mixed with it faintly was the reek of dead slugs. That, and the reddish glow, and the total lack of heat response from the wall of the tube as my palms pressed against it, gave me the unpleasant fancy that I was crawling through the gut of some unearthly behemoth, rather than exploring a strange machine. The tube branched like an artery, and there we came across our first Titanian androgyne. He, let me call it he, was sprawled on his back, like a sleeping child, his head pillowed on his slug. There was a suggestion of a smile on the little rosebud mouth. At first, I did not realize that he was dead. At first sight, the similarities between the Titanian people and ourselves are more noticeable than the differences. We impress what we expect to see on what we do see, as a wind-sculptured rock may look like a human head or dancing bear. Take the pretty little mouth, for example. How was I to know that it was an organ for breathing solely? Conceded that they are not human and that, despite the casual similarities of forelimbs and a head-like protuberance, we are less like them than is a bullfrog like a bullpup. Nevertheless, the general effect is pleasing, not frightening, and faintly human. Elfin, I should say. The elves of Saturn's moons. Had we met them before the slugs we call Titans possessed them, I think we could have gotten along with them, judged by their ability to build the saucers that were our equals, if they did build them. Certainly the slugs did not build them. Slugs are not builders, but thieves. Cosmic cuckoos. But I am letting my own later thoughts get in the way. When I saw the little fellow, I managed to draw my gun. The old man, anticipating my reaction, turned and said, "Take it easy, it's dead." "They are all dead. Smothered in oxygen when the tank ruined their air seal." I still had my gun out. "I want to burn the slug," I insisted. "It may be alive." It was not covered by the horny shell we had lately come to expect, but was naked, moist, and ugly. He shrugged. "Suit yourself. It can't possibly hurt you." "Why not?" "Wrong chemistry. That slug can't live on an oxygen breather." He crawled across the little body, giving me no chance to shoot. I had to decide to. Mary, always quick with a gun, had not drawn, but had shrunk against my side and was breathing in sharp little sobbing gasps. The old man stopped and said patiently, "Coming, Mary?" She choked, and then gasped, "Let's go back. Let's get out of here." I said, "She's all right. This is no job for three people. This is something for a research team and proper equipment." He paid no attention to me. "It has to be done. Mary, you know that. And you have to be the one to do it." "Why does she have to do it?" I demanded angrily. Again he ignored me. "Well, Mary?" From somewhere inside herself, she called on reserves. Her breathing became normal. Her features relaxed. And she crawled across the slug-ridden elfin body with the serenity of a queen going to the gallows. I lumbered after them, still hampered by my gun and trying not to touch the body. We came at last to a large chamber. It may have been the control room, for there were many of the dead little elfin creatures in it, though I saw nothing resembling, to my eye, instruments or machinery. Its inner surface was cavitated and picked out with lights much brighter than the reddish illumination, and the chamber space was festooned with processes as meaningless to me as the convolutions of a brain. I was troubled again with the thought, completely wrong, I know now, that the ship itself was a living organism. The old man paid no attention, but crawled on through, and into another ruddy, glowing tube. We followed its contortions to a place where it widened out 10 feet or more, with a ceiling overhead almost tall enough to let us stand erect. But that was not what caught our eyes. The walls were no longer opaque. On each side of us, beyond the transparent membranes, were thousands on thousands of slugs, swimming, floating, writhing in some fluid which sustained them. Each tank had an inner diffuse light of its own, and I could see back into the palpitating mass. I wanted to scream. I still had my gun out. The old man reached back and placed his hand over the bell of it. "Don't yield to temptation," he warned me. "You don't want to let that loose in here. Those are for us." Mary looked at them with a face too calm. Thinking back, I doubt that she was fully conscious in the ordinary sense. I looked at her, glanced back at the walls of that ghoulish aquarium, and said urgently, "Let's get out of here if we can, then just bomb it out of existence." "No," he said quietly. "There is more. Come." The tube narrowed in again, then enlarged, and we were again in a somewhat smaller chamber, like that of the slugs. Again, there were transparent walls, and again there were things floating beyond them. I had to look twice before I could fully make out and believe what I saw. Floating just beyond the wall, face down, was the body of a man, a human earthborn man, about 40 to 50 years old. He was grizzled and almost bald. His arms were curved across his chest, and his knees were drawn up, as if he were sleeping safe in bed, or in the womb. I watched him, thinking terrible thoughts. He was not alone. There were more beyond him, male and female, young and old. But he was the only one I could see properly, and he got my attention. I was sure that he was dead. It did not occur to me to think otherwise. Then I saw his mouth working, and then I wished he were dead. Mary was wandering around in that chamber as if she were drunk. No, not drunk, but preoccupied and dazed. She went from one transparent wall to the other, peering intently into the crowded, half-seen depths. The old man looked only at her. "Well, Mary," he said softly. "I can't find them," she said piteously in a voice like a little girl's. She ran back to the other side. The old man grasped her arm and stopped her. "You're not looking for them in the right place," he said firmly. "Go back where they are. Remember." She stopped and her voice was a wail. "I can't remember." "You must remember. Now, this is what you can do for them. You must remember where they are and look for them." Her eyes closed, and tears started leaking from them. She gasped and choked. I pushed myself between them and said, "Stop this. What are you doing to her?" He grabbed me with his free hand and pushed me away. "No, son," he whispered fiercely. "Keep out of this. You must keep out." "But, no." He let go of Mary and led me away to the entrance. "Stay there. And as you love your wife, as you hate the Titans, do not interfere. I shan't hurt her. That's a promise." "What are you going to do?" But he had turned away. I stayed, unwilling to let it go on, afraid to tamper with what I did not understand. Mary had sunk down to the floor and now squatted on it like a child, her face covered with her hands. The old man went back to her, knelt down and touched her arm. "Go back," I heard him say. "Go back to where it started." I could barely hear her answer. "No. No." "How old were you? You seemed to be about 7 or 8 when you were found. It was before that?" "Yes. Yes, it was before that." She sobbed and collapsed completely to the floor. "Mama! Mama!" "What is your mama saying?" he asked gently. "She doesn't say anything. She's looking at me so queerly. There's something on her back. I'm afraid, I'm afraid." I got up and hurried toward them, crouching to keep from hitting the low ceiling. Without taking his eyes off Mary, the old man motioned me back. I stopped, hesitated. "Go back," he ordered. "Way back." The words were directed at me, and I obeyed them. But so did Mary. "There was a ship," she muttered. "A bright, shiny ship." He said something to her. If she answered, I could not hear it. I stayed back this time and made no attempt to interfere. I could see that he was doing her no physical hurt, and despite my vastly disturbed emotions, I realized that something important was going on. Something big enough to absorb the old man's full attention in the very teeth of the enemy. He continued to talk to her, soothingly, but insistently. Mary quieted down, seemed to sink almost into lethargy, but I could hear that she answered him. After a while, she was talking in a monotonous logorrhea of emotional release. Only occasionally did the old man prompt her. I heard something crawling along the passage behind me. I turned and drew my gun, with a wild feeling that we were trapped. I almost shot him before I realized that it was the ubiquitous young officer we had left outside. "Come on out," he said urgently. He pushed on past me, out into the chamber, and repeated the demand to the old man. The old man looked exasperated beyond endurance. "Shut up and don't bother me," he said. "You've got to, sir," the youngster insisted. "The commander says that you must come out at once. We're falling back. The commander says we may have to use demolition at any moment. If we are still inside, Bluey, that's it." "Very well," the old man agreed, in unhurried tones. "We're coming. You go out and tell your commander that he must hold off until we get out. I have vitally important information. Son, help me with Mary." "Aye, aye, sir," the youngster acknowledged. "But hurry." He scrambled away. I picked up Mary and carried her to where the chamber narrowed into a tube. She seemed almost unconscious. I put her down. "We'll have to drag her," the old man said. "She may not come out of this soon. Here, let me get her up on your back. You can crawl with her." I paid no attention, but shook her. "Mary," I shouted. "Mary, can you hear me?" Her eyes opened. "Yes, Sam?" "Darling, we've got to get out of here, fast. Can you crawl?" "Yes, Sam." She closed her eyes again. I shook her again. "Mary!" "Yes, darling, what is it? I'm so tired." "Listen, Mary, you've got to crawl out of here. If you don't, the slugs will get us. Do you understand?" "All right, darling." Her eyes stayed open this time, but were vacant. I got her headed up the tube and came along after her. Whenever she faltered or slowed, I slapped at her. I lifted and dragged her through the chamber of the slugs, and again through the control room, if that was what it was. When we came to the place where the tube was partly blocked by the dead elfin creature, she stopped. I wormed my way past her and moved it, stuffing it into the branching tube. There was no doubt this time that its slug was dead. I gagged at the job. Again, I had to slap her into cooperation. After an endless nightmare of leaden-limbed striving, we reached the outer door, and the young officer was there to help us lift her out. Him pulling, and the old man and me lifting and pushing. I gave the old man a leg up, jumped out myself, and took her away from the youngster. It was quite dark. We went back the long way past the crushed house, avoiding the jungle-like break, and thence down to the beach road. Our car was no longer there. It did not matter, for we found ourselves hurried into a mud turtle tank. None too soon, for the fighting was almost on top of us. The tank commander buttoned up, and the craft lumbered off the step-back seawall, then into the water. 15 minutes later, we were inside the Fulton. And an hour later, we disembarked at the Mobile base. The old man and I had had coffee and sandwiches in the wardroom of the Fulton. So some of the WAVE officers had taken Mary and cared for her in the woman's quarters. She joined us as we left and seemed entirely normal. I said, "Mary, are you all right?" She smiled at me. "Of course, darling. Why shouldn't I be?" A small command ship and an escort took us out of there. I had supposed that we were headed back to the section offices, or more likely to Washington. I had not asked. The old man was in no mood to talk, and I was satisfied simply to hold Mary's hand and feel relieved. The pilot put us into a mountainside hangar in one of those egg-on-a-plate maneuvers that no civilian craft can accomplish, in the sky at high speed, then a cave and stationary. Like that. "Where are we?" I asked. The old man did not answer, but got out. Mary and I followed. The hangar was small. Just parking space for about a dozen craft, an arresting platform, and a single launching rack. It contained only two other ships besides ours. Guards met us and directed us on back to a door set in the living rock. We went through and found ourselves in an anteroom. An unseen metallic voice told us to strip off what little we wore. I did not mind being naked, but I hated to part with my gun and phone. We went on inside and were met by a young fellow whose total clothing was an armband, showing three chevrons and crossed retorts. He turned us over to a girl who was wearing even less, as her armband had only two chevrons. Both of them noticed Mary, each with typical gender response. I think the corporal was glad to pass us on to the captain who received us. "We got your message," the captain said. "Dr. Steelton is waiting." "Thank you, ma'am," the old man answered. "The sooner the better." "Where?" "Just a moment," she said. Went to Mary and felt through her hair. "We have to be sure, you know," she said apologetically. If she was aware of the falseness of much of Mary's hair, she did not mention it, and Mary did not flinch. "All right," she decided. "Let's go." Her own hair was cut mannishly short in crisp gray waves. "Right," agreed the old man. "No, son, this is as far as you go."
"Why?"
I asked.
"Because you darn near loused up the first try," he explained briefly. "Now pipe down."
The captain said, "The officer's mess is straight down the first passageway to the left. Why don't you wait there?" So, I did. On the way, I passed a door decorated primly in large red skull and crossbones and stenciled with, "Warning, live parasites beyond this door." In smaller letters, it added, "Qualified personnel only. Use procedure A." I gave the door a wide berth. The officer's mess was the usual clubroom, and there were three or four men and two women lounging in it. No one seemed interested in my presence, so I found an unoccupied chair, sat down, and wondered just who you had to be to get a drink around this joint. After a time, I was joined by a large male extrovert, wearing a colonel's insignia on a chain around his neck. With it was a St. Christopher's medal and an ID dog tag.
"Newcomer?"
he asked. I admitted it.
"Civilian expert?" he went on.
"I don't know about expert," I replied. "I'm a field operative."
"Name?"
Sorry to be officious," he apologized. "But I'm alleged to be the security officer around here. My name's Kelly." I told him mine. He nodded.
"Matter of fact, I saw your party coming in."
Mine was the voice of conscience, coming out of the wall.
"Now, Mr. Nivens, how about a drink?
From the brief we had on you, you could use one." I stood up. "Whom do I have to kill to get it?"
Though as far as we can see, Kelly went on sometime later, this place needs a security officer the way a horse needs roller skates. We should publish our results as fast as we get them. This isn't like fighting a human enemy. I commented that he did not sound like the ordinary brass hat. He laughed and did not take offense. Believe me, son, not all brass hats are as they are pictured. They just seem to be. I remarked that Air Marshal Rexton struck me as a pretty sharp citizen. You know him? The colonel asked. I don't know him exactly, but my work on this job has thrown me in his company a good bit. I last saw him earlier today. Said the colonel. I've never met the gentleman. You move in more rarefied strata than I do, sir. I explained that it was mere happenstance, but from then on he showed me more respect. Presently he was telling me about the work the laboratory did. By now we know more about those foul creatures than does old Nick himself. But do we know how to kill them without killing our hosts? We do not. Of course, he went on, if we could lure them one at a time into a small room and douse them with anesthetics, we could save the hosts. But that is like the old saw about how to catch a bird. Naturally, it's no trouble if you can sneak up close enough to put salt on its tail. I'm not a scientist myself, just the son of a cop, and a cop myself under a different tag. But I've talked to the scientists here, and I know what we need. This is a biological war, and it will be won by biological warfare. What we need is a bug, one that will bite the slug and not the host. Doesn't sound too hard, does it? It is. We know 100 things that will kill the slug. Smallpox, typhus, syphilis, encephalitis lethargica, Obermeyer's virus, plague, yellow fever, and so on. But they kill the host, too. Couldn't they use something that everyone is immune to? I asked. Take typhoid. Everybody has typhoid shots, and almost everybody is vaccinated for smallpox. No good. If the host is immune, the parasite doesn't get exposed to it. Now that the slugs have developed this outer cuticle, the parasite's environment is the host. No. We need something the host will catch and that will kill the slug. It won't give the host more than a mild fever or a splitting headache. I started to answer with some no doubt brilliant thought when I saw the old man standing in the doorway. I excused myself and went to him. What was Kelly grilling you about? He asked. He wasn't grilling me, I answered. That's what you think. Don't you know what Kelly that is? Should I? You should. Or perhaps you shouldn't. He never lets his picture be taken. That's B.J. Kelly, the greatest scientific criminologist of our generation. That Kelly? But he's not in the army. Reserve, probably. But you can guess how important this laboratory is. Come on. Where's Mary? You can't see her now. She's recuperating. Is she hurt? I promised you she would not be hurt. Stilton is the best in his line, but we had to go down deep, against a great deal of resistance. That's always rough on the subject. I thought about it. Did you get what you were after? Yes and no. We got a great deal, but we aren't through. What were you after? We had been walking along one of the endless underground passageways of which the place was made. Now he turned us into a small empty office, and we sat down. The old man touched the communicator on the desk and said, "Private conference." "Yes, sir," a voice answered. "We will not record." A green light came on in the ceiling. "Not that I believe them," the old man complained, "but it may keep anyone but Kelly from playing it back. Now, son, About what you want to know. I'm not sure you are entitled to it. You are married to the girl, but that doesn't mean that you own her soul. And this stuff comes from down so deep that she did not know she had it herself. I said nothing. There was nothing to say. He went on presently, in worried tones. Still, it might be better to tell you enough so that you will understand. Otherwise, you would be bothering her to find out. That, I don't want to happen. I don't ever want that to happen. You might throw her into a bad wingding. I doubt if she'll remember anything herself. Steelton is a very gentle operator. But you could stir up things. I took a deep breath. You'll have to judge. I can't. Yes, I suppose so. Well, I'll tell you a bit and answer your questions. Some of them. In exchange for a solemn promise never to bother your wife with...